Back up, please. Da 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 da. Hello and welcome to the Point Blank Show. My name is Abhishek and our guest today is David Bodanis, the prolific author of several books. His most recent work, The Art of Fairness, The Power of Decency in a World Turned Mean, is something that we all should read at least once to understand what is it that we can get done if we are a little decent and fair with people. Thank you very much, David, for agreeing to do this.
Thank you. This really looking forward.
This is a question that you might have been asked a million times, but don't nice guys finish last? Is that not the established principle out there or something that is drilled in by sports coaches or principals or even bosses? If somebody's being meek, how do you react to that?
I think you're entirely right. And in fact, I have a chapter in the book about the person who came up with the phrase, nice guys finish last. And I think sadly, in this real world, that's correct. I mean, in a family, we teach our children to always be fair and always polite and always try to be helpful. It doesn't always work, but that's what we teach. But in the real world, if somebody is always nice and always does what other people ask, they get stepped on, sort of like they become like a doormat or a rug. Imagine if you said yes to everybody who said, oh, do you mind just putting your work aside for a little bit and helping me with this? Or could you help me with that? If you say yes all the time, you're very nice, but you get crushed. So we know that being too nice, too soft doesn't work. So what's the other extreme? The other extreme is being like really hard. And in companies and organizations, we've often met people like that. They're just really hard and vicious, and they scream and they yell, and even if they don't scream and yell, they can be very cold, and they're remorseless in getting what they want done right now. Now, there's some advantages to that. People like that in the short term, they can be very successful in business. If you ask people in tech, they say, yeah, somebody like that, if they need to fire people, if you're losing money, they can fire them straight away. And I know myself, sometimes if people yell at you, you say, okay, sure, and you react quickly so they can get things done. The question of the book is, so here is too soft, here is very hard. Is there a line in between? Is there a way to travel in between where you're not merely nice, but you don't have to be a bully to get things done? Now, a lot of people say, no, there's no such line. It's a real shame in religious studies. We teach people to be nice, but that's not the real world. You have to be a jerk. And I suppose my point is that between being nice and being a jerk, there's something in between. Being fair but firm. And that's really hard to do. So I thought, if I write a book saying, listen, everybody, you don't have to be, being merely nice fails, being a real tough guy can succeed, but it isn't maybe that perfect. And I, David, believe there's a middle way. You might say, yeah, Bodanis, you're a very nice man, but really, why should I listen to you, a quiet author in London? So I thought, aha, I will prove them wrong by finding examples of other people who did it. People in real worlds, people in the construction industry, in the military, in aviation, in medicine, in politics, in warfare. Really tough, difficult fields where being too soft, it loses. It's a shame, but it loses. But being really super hard sometimes is counterproductive.
And you do write that you can succeed without being a jerk, and that being fair isn't about being soft. So that balance that you're talking about, how difficult is it? Because these days, words of encouragement in the corporate world are quite rare. It doesn't come as openly or naturally because it might be perceived as you are being a little too generous with your praise. So often people take route of being more firm than one needs to be, flush with examples of how people have gotten big things done by being reasonably fair. And I think one of the interesting ones, examples that you write about comes right at the beginning of the book. And if you could take a crack at what Danny Boyle did back in 2012 before the Olympics opening ceremony, if you can just tell the listeners what that was, because that was quite interesting. It's a huge project and he managed to get that done without using any of the conventional techniques.
Yeah, so that was a real surprise. So Danny Boyle is the great film director. He's done lots and lots of films. I think he's gotten the Academy Award. Nice English guy. And he was asked before London had the Olympics over a decade ago now to do the opening ceremonies. And they really wanted good opening ceremonies. And he wanted to really have a creative, good thing that showed the best of Britain. And even was honest about, you know, the worst of Britain. He wanted to be a full three-dimensional thing. But also, perhaps above all, he wanted to keep it a secret. He wanted all the rehearsals to go on, because it takes over a year or 2 years to do the rehearsals. And when it went live, it would go live for a huge audience. You know, a lot of people who don't follow TV much, they'll watch the opening of the Olympics. It's like watching the 100 meters men's final sprint. You want to see who's the best, even if you don't follow sports. So many people, they wanted to see it. And it was going to be live. So we thought, if there's an announcement for a new product from Apple, a new iPhone or a new computer, they try to keep it a secret so that everybody's excited when it comes out. So it turned out, for the main part of his preparations, he needed about 10,000 volunteers to go through all the stuff. And in the week or two right before the show, it went up to 60,000 people, including filling the stadium, because the stadium was interactive. There were lights and things going on. So how could you get 10,000 people to keep a secret? So there's one possibility. He asked the International Olympic Committee, based in Lausanne, Switzerland, what to do. They said, it's actually very simple. Everybody has cell phones, even then people had cell phones. So you absolutely confiscate all the cell phones so nobody can secretly take a picture. The other thing you have to do is have them sign non-disclosure agreements, legally binding things, and try to have a lawyer there and maybe a policeman at the same time to give them a very stern talking to so that they will not be tempted to do any of that. And Danny Boyle said, thank you very much, but I'm going to make sure everybody keeps their cell phone and there'll be no non-disclosure agreements. And they said, why? Why are you possibly doing that? He said, if you terrify people, you can get people who might follow simple direct orders, but they'll show no initiative. The creative people won't come up with creative ideas. The technical people, they won't work hard when situation is difficult. I'll have terrified automata, like little robots. I don't want that. But the question is still, how can you keep it a secret? The top person from the London Organizing Committee was a man named Sebastian Coe, who a generation or two generations ago was an Olympic winning runner, middle distance, a great runner. So Danny Boyle and Sebastian Coe became not close friends, but they spent time with each other and they really admired and respected each other. Anyways, he had a lot of experience with crowds from all around the world. And he said to Danny Boyle, said, you know what? If you try to keep a secret, secret's going to come out. Everybody, if you use the word secret, it's like, oh, it's like it's pressure down, like keeping a boiling kettle down. It's going to come out. But what if you switch it? What if instead of talking about a secret, you talk about a surprise? You say, save the surprise. Now, you know, if you whisper to a friend or a colleague, oh, there's a secret, they want to gossip to somebody else. But if you say, for example, somebody else is having a birthday party, say, there's a surprise party coming up, don't tell them. What sort of human being is going to break a surprise and tell it? So they started putting around the places where they were doing the rehearsals, big car factories and open parking lots, big hash marks, save the surprise, save the surprise. And it turned out all the 10,000 people, they loved it. They respected that. They saved the surprise. No one leaked. And it turned out that there were some people who were infiltrated to the crowd from newspapers in London, a few of the lower quality newspapers. They wanted to send people in there to find out what was going on. And those people, maybe at the beginning, they would have had that view, but they saw that, save the surprise, they had solidarity with everybody else. They also saw that Danny Boyle was one of them. When there was hammering to be done, his chief of the construction would join in. When they had to do rehearsals when it was raining, and in England, it rains a lot in London. So Danny Boyle would stay out there. If the rehearsals went till midnight or 1 a.m., he'd stay out there in the rain with everybody. They realized the team was together. On the other hand, if Danny Boyle was merely soft, that wouldn't work. So for example, when he was filming Slumdog Millionaire, I don't know if that was entirely filmed in India or partly. Anyways, it turned out—
Most of it, yeah.
Yeah, great film. One of his senior crew at the last minute said, oh, by the way, you have to double my salary. And Danny Boyle said, you know what? It's not going to happen. Because if he had said yes to that person, everybody else would have said, oh, at the last minute, we're already here with the big cameras and stuff. You have a lot to lose. Double my salary. But he had experience. People try that on in Chicago and New York and London and Delhi, wherever they were filming. That's what human beings are like. If you're soft and nice and polite, say, oh, yeah, I understand. I'll give you more money. He had given fair salaries at the beginning. He wasn't going to give in and be extorted. And the people accepted that. They were just trying it on. Think of a parent who always spoils their child, and the child looks around and says, can I have more cake, or can I stay up a little bit later? If the parent says yes, it's in the short term, it's easy, but the precedent, kid can come a bit spoiled. So Danny Boyle, I loved his story. He was an example of listening to others, being open to Sebastian Coe, who looked different on the outside, getting this great insight about what pulls people together. And he found that if he was generous, he got gratitude, generosity coming back.
I quote from your book, and you write that Danny Boyle always treated his film crews with respect, never letting them go without decent meal breaks, never asking them to work extra hours without pay, respecting their judgment when they had expertise to do. Now, when you read these things, there should be a default characteristic in everyone, because that is the way you would get the best out of folks. But then why do smart people do silly things, if not stupid? Because there are names. On the other hand, you also write about folks like Steve Ballmer, who was the head of Microsoft when I was growing up in school and possibly in college at the time. And YouTube had just around, you know, come there. So the, some of the videos posted of he standing up on the stage and making a meal out of some competitor going down. Or you write how he confiscated an iPhone of one of the Microsoft employees, saying
he crushed
that he crushed it, didn't he? And he was still the head of an organization. Microsoft did well at the time as well. But you write that why such kind of leadership could be toxic and will not sustain itself over time.
You nailed it with the word sustain. And you also nailed it with that it can happen with intelligent people. Steve Ballmer studied mathematics at Harvard, which is hard to do. He was as good as Bill Gates, which is hard to do. Steve Ballmer's a really intelligent man. I mean, just really sharp, really quick in conversation. And when he isn't being angry, he can actually be very polite and civilized and stuff. Unfortunately, he got angry easily. Now think of the example I was talking about, a spoiled child. You know, all two-year-olds or three-year-olds, suppose they start out equally, but somewhere in a family where they can do whatever they want. If they push something over, the mommy or daddy say, oh, that's okay, you can push it again. Or if there's a kid who's bothering them and they punch the kid in the back of the head and the parents say, well, you deserve to protect yourself. It's okay. After a while, that kid will become a monster. So Steve Ballmer was at Microsoft early on, and Microsoft was rising very quickly. By the way, Steve Ballmer is huge. He's fat, but he's also a huge man. He looks like an American football player or rugby player. He's a great big guy. So he would physically intimidate most people. He found that just by standing close with most people, they'd be scared and they'd back away. That's interesting. He also found he was getting really rich because Microsoft was automatically getting rich. They had this monopoly on their operating system. And he also realized he was quicker witted than many other people. So it sort of went to his head. A parent puts limits on what a child does, and that's good for the child if it's reasonable limits. Steve Ballmer didn't have limits put on him. He was smarter than almost everybody. He had more money than almost everybody. His company somehow automatically was moving very well. His physical presence could make people be scared of him and stuff. So instead of becoming, I don't know, the decent, polite guy that he might be with his family, in public, he began to develop these terrible habits. One day, there was an engineer at Microsoft, a software engineer, who said that he was going to be moving to a competing company. Steve Ballmer grabbed a chair and threw it at his head. It turns out that engineer was an athlete and shifted sideways. The chair went past him. Now, often when somebody's big in business, there's lots of scurrilous stories about them that are made up. But we know this one isn't made up. The software engineer testified in court under his name that this happened and stuff. And somebody said, did Ballmer really do that? And he said, look, have you ever played golf with a guy? He'll be like really friendly when you're playing golf. But if he misses a shot, he'll be screaming and complaining and smashing his things down, just acting like a big baby. I think every baby will act like a baby. But if it's never blocked, it'll continue acting like a baby. So it turns out, because Microsoft had many advantages, Bill Gates was a good manager, it was going well. And Ballmer was head, I can't remember for how many years, like close to a decade. If you had invested $100 in Microsoft when he started, by the time he finished, almost a decade later, it'd be worth about $80. So it went down about 20%. And his successor was a man who was the opposite, Satya Nadella, I think he had grown up in India and then went to university or graduate school in Milwaukee and then moved to the West Coast. And his personality, he wasn't a perfect person, But he had some tragedy when he was a new parent. He had a child who had real difficulties. And at first he raged and screamed. And then he realized, why am I the center of the world? I'm not. What if my wife and I decide to really help this child as best as we can to develop the best way the little boy could? And that gave him a greater compassion for other people. Now, again, this isn't being soft. You don't rise up in software at Microsoft by being soft. There will always be people who will try to steal your intellectual property, and there'll be people who try to take advantage of you. So he'd be firm. He'd have lawyers. He would say no. When he had to fire people, he would do it. But his reflex was to be encouraging. So Steve Ballmer had strict boundaries around the company. Everybody outside is an enemy. Everybody inside, I'm still suspicious about. Nandadella said, look, there's a lot of really smart people outside. One of the first things he did was put up a sign behind him when he was talking. Steve Ballmer had been against the sort of software that is just developed, in a sense, without pay, Linux and other operating systems. Nadella put up a sign, I love Linux. He encouraged people to get to know Apple, maybe work some stuff together. Again, they're competitors, but you're open and you can learn. If you had invested $100 in Microsoft when Nadella took over, at about the similar amount of time, he was there long, I think he's still there. He was there longer than Ballmer, but after the same amount of time, a bit under a decade, it would be worth around $800. So it was really effective. I knew people in the tech world on the West Coast in America. And when Ballmer was head, the good people, really creative, top software engineers, they didn't want to work there. Somebody who was known for screaming and smashing his fist onto the table and yelling at people. Women especially didn't want to work there. It's like he was never a sexual predator, but he was scary. Big, imagine a huge guy putting his face right up to you, big veins, sweating, smashing his fist. People would stay away. So all sorts of good people and creative people didn't want to go there. And he was having these counterproductive effects.
To play the devil's advocate, if somebody has been industry in a while, they know from whatever we've read about Steve Jobs, he happened to have a temper himself. Now, he was a genius, all right. He knew how to market his products. He knew how to talk. He would rehearse. He wasn't the best of managers from the relationship point of view, was he? In terms of he getting the best out of people, but in a manner that could, dare I say, be condescending. But yeah, some folks might say that, hey, you don't understand him. He's a genius. He can get away with certain things because he's changing the world. So is there an extreme where some folks can be unhinged because they are trying to do something which the ordinary folk will not understand, and the few that who would will forgive those flaws for a greater good? Or is it just too esoteric a concept to understand?
No, that's a great point. Sometimes, suppose there's a doctor who's normally, quite decent in people, and somebody comes in from a motorcycle accident. They're on a trolley. The doctor has to hurry them down the hall to an operating room, and he'll scream at somebody, get the F out of the way, just get out of the way, because it's life or death. So you're allowed to do that in extreme cases. With Steve Jobs, I never met him personally, but I've met people who worked with him and chatted with him and read some of the same stuff you have. So I'm not an expert, but my guess is like this. There were a number of products that he pushed against opposition at Apple that did not sell well. A computer that was a perfect cube without rounded edges. Turns out it's immensely cheaper to make slightly rounded edges than to have perfectly square edges. Certain other products, times he wouldn't listen to marketing. So there were times under his administration when Apple went down. As you know, famously, he got fired, but then he came back to great success. His skill seems to have been, although he was near that edge, he wasn't crazily irrational. There were people he would listen to. His top designer was a man named Johnny Ives, now Sir Johnny Ives, a British guy. So those beautiful designs at Apple did not come from Steve Jobs, but he had the calmness and the modesty to listen to Johnny Ives, Little Music one.
iPod.
Now that's a historical object, but a generation ago, it was fairly effective. And even today, look at it and say, oh, it's really cool. Many of the Apple computer designs, much of the iPhone, there was Johnny Ives. Someone like Ballmer would have screamed and yelled, he was so far over this level. How dare you come up with something I didn't think of it? How dare you? Steve Jobs, he could scream and yell. He could have a bad temper. There's no question about it. But there are times when he would, okay, Johnny, yeah, that's good. That's very good. He might then later in a meeting pretend he took credit or something like that. But so he wasn't entirely here. If he was entirely here, that'd be no good. There's also a difference between a style and substance. So some people, some cultures raise their voices a lot. Other cultures don't. I spent some time in Scandinavia, right in the north of Europe. People there are very calm. If somebody there says, hey, like that, that's really extreme. I grew up in Chicago. If somebody there says, hey, like that, that's nothing. That's really soft. So we know there's different cultures, even different parts of whatever city you are. People have different views. So Steve Jobs, he would sometimes be mean and try to undercut a person, but very often he was just like an angry person who expressed it. And people say, okay, you know, if you're fair underneath, you don't have to like a person, you don't have to love them, but you have to respect them. So on the whole, not always, sometimes his judgment was very poor when Apple went down. But if you thought, wow, I work under this guy who can yell a bit like an idiot, but he listens to Johnny Ives and respects him. He listens to some of the other marketing people and respects them. He listens to people who came up with the Macintosh operating system and respects them. So he's a moderate jerk, but he's not a major jerk. The other point you mentioned, which I thought is a really good one, some people say, you don't realize how important this project is. On anything else, yeah, maybe I'd be nice. But if something is really, really important, you have to be just let it out. And that's one of the another reason I wrote this book. That view is wrong. And the proof there is that there are some things as difficult as anything could be, where you don't have to be like that. I'll give a couple of examples. In fact, one of these examples helped me start with the book. So as you know, I've written several books about Albert Einstein. Originally, I was in physics, and Einstein was a cool guy. Anyways, I was in a meeting a number of years ago at a big bank, and one of the people, top level, and one of the people there, I wasn't an employee, I was a consultant to them. And one of the people there was really rude. He was really insulting to everybody else. I was sitting quietly to the side, so he ignored me. Afterwards, I said, oh, why were you, wasn't that a little bit much? He said, well, I'm so much smarter than them. If you're really smart, you have the right to tell people what they think, what you think. And Albert Einstein was smarter than him. Albert Einstein was smarter than anybody. So if the sheer intelligence justifies this, then Albert Einstein would do it. In fact, Albert Einstein wasn't like that. If he would disagree with people, say, well, look at it this way. What about this argument? He never put people down. In fact, one time he was giving a seminar in Berlin in the early 1920s, and he was in the audience, and a woman was giving a seminar. There were not that many women in theoretical physics then. Somebody from the audience tried to be really insulting to her. Einstein stood up. He said, if you're making those powerful points, why don't you go to the chalkboard and see if you can do better? I'll ask you some critical questions along the way. And the guy shut up and stuff. So there's no excuse to be a bully. Special forces teams around the world, in India and England and America, you know, super elite soldiers and stuff. Almost always, they will not take somebody who's a thug. In the movies, you can have a thug, but in real life, they need people who, under stress, will be fair. They'll use a gun if they have to, but to themselves and the team, they do not want a crazed bully running around, even if it's a life or death hostage situation. That's especially when you need to be calm. The whole second half of the Art of Fairness book, or the final third, I talk about World War II. During World War II, at one point in Norway, there was a nasty collaborationist government. And the head of the nasty government there said, the people want to call me a forer, F-O-E-R-E-R, the Norwegian word, or close to it, to match the German word Führer, mein Führer, you know, the German word for Hitler. And the Germans said, no, you can't do that. Only we superior Germans can use that word. So even their allies couldn't do it. And as the war went on, all these people who had been allied to Germany, they stepped away. They didn't really want to be allied with that. They weren't friends. You know, there's some people when you were at school, there might be a bully at your school. And there's people in his gang. They usually don't love him. They're scared of him. And the moment he begins to go down or show weakness, they peel away. While the U.S. and Britain got more and more allies coming together. I'll give a final brief example about that from a different field. A number of years ago in Hollywood, there was this producer, Harvey Weinstein. You may have heard of him. He was a very skilled producer. He made a number of great films, but it turned out he was a horrible man. He yelled and screamed. That could be style, but he was also a sexual predator. And I think he's in jail now. It seems like he should spend the rest of his life in jail. So when he was on top of the world, everybody supported him. All the many actresses, they were coerced. They were forced. They said, oh, yeah, we like working with Harvey. His brother said, Harvey's great. All these people who wanted to make films said, yeah, good old Harvey. The moment he began to be attacked in court and begin to go down, even his brother said, well, Harvey's a jerk. All these people said, I always hated Harvey. So if you're a good person, if you have some problems, people will support you as you have your ups and downs in life. If you're someone like Harvey Weinstein or Germany in World War II, once you begin to show weakness, they never liked you. They're in for the kill.
Yeah. And also, you talked about listening there a few times, wherein it's important to be a good listener. This phrase is overabused. But the examples that you give, whether it was Ballmer or Steve Jobs, one point you make in your book is if there is unwelcome news, and if you are somebody who doesn't like to hear a no, then people won't come and tell you if something is wrong. And that could be catastrophic. I think you write about a plane that crashed because the co-pilot was too timid, and rightly so, to tell his pilot that he was doing something wrong and the plane crashed. Isn't that right?
Yeah. So that was a 747. It's, I don't know if it's still produced, a huge Boeing plane. Luckily, there was only the crew on board. It was a cargo plane and it was flying out of London. And I think it was flying all the way to Korea. And the pilot was really bossy. The tape recording has survived, the recording from the cockpit, where even when they were getting ready for the runway, he was yelling at the co-pilot and saying, you idiot, do this, you know, do that. But he said it in a way that was very insulting. You have to give instructions. Like, and sometimes if you're pressed for time, you don't have time to give long, careful instructions. So you might say, David, pull that throttle, press that button, do this. That's okay. You don't have time to say, please, would you mind? I fully accept that. But he was very mean and scornful. And then when the co-pilot tried saying some other things about, oh, you know, we're doing the flight. I had this concern about the fuel, et cetera. The pilot would just look at him and say, shut up, just shut up. Anyways, as they were taking off, there was a problem with the instruments. The instruments seemed to show that they were taking off straight, even though, in fact, they were tilted. And when you're in an airplane accelerating, you often can't tell if you're tilted a bit. You know, sometimes when you're in a commercial jet, you look out the window and you realize, wow, the ground's below me because you're tilted. But the momentum centripetal effect just carries you along. So it was getting worse and worse and worse. The co-pilot could see it. And the recorder shows, and there's also a flight engineer in the cockpit also. And either they tried to say it to the captain, or the captain was grumbling and told them to shut up. But they didn't say, and it crashed at full speed into the ground, killing all of them. So after that, people found that the way to make airplanes safer, and indeed now they're really quite safe, involved bringing in psychologists as much as aeronautical engineers. So most airlines around the world, when a crew gets together, they have to speak to each other, which sounds silly, but often crews meet for the first time in a cockpit. So the head of the chief steward and the air hostesses, they have to start saying a little bit to each other, the pilot and the co-pilot, and if there's a third flight engineer, they also have to speak. And they have clear rules, including that the co-pilot is always allowed to say, this is important, you have to listen. And the pilot has to listen. He can be penalized if he doesn't listen. This doesn't mean always doing what the co-pilot wants. Pilots are pilots for good reason. They have a lot of experience. They might be sensible. Right. But to say, oh, shut up and don't tell me anything, not very helpful.
And how does it work in very high pressure situations where, for example, in sports, football managers, if any one of our listeners, if you follow the English Premier League or anywhere else for that matter, they get sacked within 40 days to 2 years, and they've got very little time to squeeze the most out of their players. You've written a little bit about Jose Mourinho in one of your articles in the FT, and I do follow him for whatever little. Now, you've got Jose Mourinho on one side, you have Jurgen Klopp, who is currently the manager of Liverpool. Both appear to have very distinct styles, and yet players are willing to take the proverbial bullet for either of them. And it appears that, you know, Mourinho is a brash character on the outside. And I read something around John Terry, who was a former captain of Chelsea. And he said that he still scares me to this day, but he says, I would leave that pitch in a coffin for him, unquote. That those are his words. So what is it about really tough managers, whether in the corporate world or on the sports field, that make you dislike them at times, but you still respect them because is it that their heart is in the right place? They do not have an agenda. They won't be soft on any given day after retirement. And in hindsight, they say, hey, he was the guy who got the most out of me. And had he been a little more civil to me, I would not have been as great. So how is that? How does one square with that balance?
I think you nailed it with the word respect. So there's some people who think, I know how to be as good as Jose Mourinho. What I'll do is I'll yell at everybody all the time. Well, it turns out that doesn't work. Or the American baseball manager who came up with the phrase, nice guys finish last. His name was Leo Durocher. He screamed a lot and pushed at people. At times he was successful. And if I say, I know how I'm going to be like Leo Durocher, I'll scream a lot and I'll push at people. It's not enough. Mourinho knew a lot about American soccer. He's very, very skilled. Leo Durocher knew a lot about baseball. If you really trust the person, suppose you're a soldier and you have two possible officers to take you and your men forward. One officer is really polite. He'll say, well, David, tell me about your feelings. But he's not that competent. He's not really good on reconnaissance and skill. Mm. And each time he comes back with 10 men, only two or three are alive. You don't want to go out with that officer. You might want to have a drink with him. You might want to like be friends with him. You don't want to go in the army with him. Suppose there's another officer who's a real nasty person. You don't like him. He's just crude and unpleasant or mean. But every time he goes out with 10 people, he comes back with 10 people and gets his mission done. You would say, you know what? This is worth it. This is I need to survive. I'm going to do what he says. Now, it turns out, so that's one level of it. But within that, the officers who are only mean, only angry or especially spiteful, they tend not to be the ones who come back with 10 men. Again, I spent a while talking to quite a few people in special force organizations around the world in a new book I'm working on. That's a big part of it. And they repeatedly said, the officer who's like in the movies, who just yells and is a bully, you don't get the best out of your people. They're not going to take the initiative. They're not going to like crawl an extra distance to look for you. They'll just passively look. They won't be creative. They won't be innovative. Think of a case where a hotel is taken over by terrorists, right? And a special forces team comes in to help it. There's going to be times when those individuals are on their own. You know, you fan out and you go to different floors and stuff, maybe in small groups. The officer who might be the bully and stuff, if you depend on him doing everything, it won't work. Or if you hate him so much that you don't want to help and you're scared to take initiative, then you won't be creative and take initiative, which seems to be the only way these things get done.
So in other words, it is if you are a monster in the right way, in that, for example, you talked about Ballmer being a monster at the time, and which is not the right kind, but Mourinho, for that matter, or you talked about substance over style. Mm-hmm. Now, if you have the substance, then you can get away by pushing the right buttons to get the best out of people.
And the buttons, I suppose sometimes there's two ways to get the same result. I don't know football, but I do know basketball. In Chicago, people just say, David, you're just tall enough to be bad at basketball. I was tall enough to be able to play, but I wasn't tall enough to be that good at it. Because if you have a basketball and I want to bounce it and keep it at this level of height, I can go like this, hit it down, bam, hurt it down. Mm. Or I can put my hand under it when it comes up each time. My hand under it and it comes up. I coach some other sports in London. I sometimes coach kickboxing, of all things. Wow. And one way, some people, if you just yell at them and say, come on, damn it, just do it, they'll go the extra mile. They're really tired, but they don't want the abuse, and they'll do a little bit more. And with some people, that actually works. That's effective. Other people recoil. If you say that, they just get angry and they shut down. But you say, you know what? I think you can do the extra. I really think it. So you can go that far. And also many coaches who try to copy the bully, the one who's really mean, you need those skills underneath. An excellent example there is just fitness. At university, I ran a track. Again, I was a decent track runner, but there I was on a team that was superb. It had the best athlete in the world that year, a man named Rick Volsetter, who won the Sullivan Award for the best amateur athlete. And one of the coaches was one of the three top U.S. Olympic coaches. I was just a kid on the edge, but there were some people there I could observe who were great. If you have a coach who pushes somebody too hard, it's counterproductive. Suppose you can lift 20 pounds or 50 pounds. If I say, great, lift 100 pounds, maybe you can do it. If I say, okay, now lift 250 pounds, you'll tear your shoulder. If you're not experienced with it, you'll say it's counterproductive. You can be harsh, but if you're too harsh, it's counterproductive.
It reminds me of a story that Gary Oldman, the great English actor, filmmaker, he was talking about Christopher Nolan. I think they've done quite a few films together for the Batman series.
Yeah.
He says that Nolan knows his craft so well that he's given me just two instructions in the last 7 years or six to seven films. And one of them was the stakes are higher, or the stakes are high in a scene. So he just took that, and then he had to act accordingly because his energy levels had dipped in a scene that required him to be a little more ferocious.
Great
so
point.
Knowing what to say is a function of how good you are at your trade, and how you say it is just a matter of personality and character then.
Yes, you're quite right about what to say. That's a great insight. Also, I'm guessing, again, I don't know either of these people, but I'm guessing Nolan knows enough about actors that they're different. There's different human beings. There's some people like Gary Oldman, if you say that in a conversational tone, they'll respond well. Other people, they might not be able to take it in. You might have to mime it or sort of, no, what I want you to do is lean like this and speak like that. It's fine. Gary Oldman clearly doesn't need that. He has some words. Other people, maybe you have to raise their voice to get them done. So a good director will understand the different tools. Again, think of a good school teacher. If they treat every child the same, it won't work. There's some kids you got to be really firm with. Others, it helps to make a joke. Others, you want to be encouraging. Others, each one has a different view. There was an American general, Norman Schwarzkopf, who led the American forces in the first Gulf War over 30 years ago, I think in 1991. And he said, on average, if he had soldiers who were from the countryside, who were farmers, what worked well was to not explain logically why something should do, and certainly not to yell at them. Farmers will just take it. But to say it's good common sense to do it. If there are people who are more like university graduates, what worked really well was to explain. The reason we want you to do this is because the enemy will think that and it makes sense. It's, okay, got it. And then they'll go. There's other people you just yell at. And they respond, they respect yelling and they respond to yelling. And especially if they trust you, if they know that you get things done. So, I mean, Schwarzkopf was simplifying. It was in probably a ghosted autobiography. But the point holds, different messages for different audiences, but especially different styles. And the correct word shouldn't be different styles. The correct word should be appropriate styles.
Right. This Mike Brearley, the former England captain of the cricket team, when England came from behind to win a historic test series against arch rivals Australia back in the day, he knew that he could wind up a cricketer like Ian Botham, who's a great all-rounder of the game. But he would not do the same with Bob Willis, another bowler whom he would tell Ian Botham, my grandmom could bowl faster than you. And he would wind him up. But if you say something similar to another legend called Bob Willis, he would go into his shell. So he would have a different kind of technique with him.
That's exactly it. So it has to be appropriate. Plus, I'm guessing they all respected the manager. They respected the coach. If I were to tell a top cricketer what to do, they'd smile, but they say, look, I have no reason to follow you. And I can say it in a friendly way. I can say it in a harsh way. It's irrelevant. I don't know cricket. So once you have the respect, then you need the channel. All these are ways to go through that middle line. Again, not being terribly soft, saying, hey, whatever you want to do, Mr. Botham, even if Botham is having a bad day and needs to be corrected, nor is it screaming in the identical way at everybody. It's counterproductive.
Yep. And last couple of questions. I know we've almost run out of time, David, is in your research of this book or over the years, you also gave an example of back in the day when you were doing research for the book on Einstein. Has it changed you as a person in some way? Are you more trusting of people by default? For instance, I ask you this because you were gracious enough to let a stranger like me read a little bit of a manuscript of your forthcoming book to seek an opinion.
Yeah.
The confidence of trusting a rank stranger in India whom you've never met, is that something that you practice as well? And how does it help?
If I write books for the general public, even if I didn't know you, I would think, well, if somebody can follow it and they like it, then that's good. And if they can't, there's no way of saying they're wrong. It's like, well, I haven't taken their audience into account. An example there would be, so this is the first level. You're actually at a different level. But the first level would be, I don't know, if you have a video podcast and you ask somebody, by the way, is the focus good? or is the background coloration appropriate? If they say, no, it's kind of blurry to me, you have to accept their view. It's blurry to them. I mean, they might have need corrective lenses, or they don't have their contacts in. But if they're being honest, that's a valid thing. That was especially strong when I used to write science books. If an argument wasn't clear, it'd be no good for me to say to the person, oh, you should have studied more when you're studying in school. If it's not clear, it's not clear. And that's really useful to hear. The same thing when you do a test with the microphone, testing. If there's a distortion, you have to know that. So that's one level. The other level is I thought, well, okay, like here's this guy who putting together this video thing and the podcast and stuff, and is clearly interested in communications and might have some subtle insights about how communications works and stuff. Also, if I've written some books where the final drafts, I think, are usually good enough, they range between okay to very good, that they really vary. And I won't say which are which, but the first drafts are often very poor. And if somebody says, you know what, I really like the material, but I found it hard to get into. That for me is very useful to hear. Sort of like if you have an idea of you yourself, if you have an idea for a new business or a new angle you want to take your productions in, and you give a sample of the pitch to somebody and they say, you know what, I'm sure you have something good. It's not yet clear to me. That's really useful to hear. That's really useful. The final solutions for it, that's for the author to work out. It's sort of like I can't tell people how to get better clothes, but I can say, ooh, you know, that those stripes, to me, they don't look right on you. And somebody else who's a really good consultant say, ah, of course, with that build, they need, you know, such and such material. So I really like that. Aristotle, 2,400 years ago or whatever, said that art, anything that's artistic, it's sort of separated out from you. I know dance is difficult because your body does it, but painting, music, books and stuff, there's you, the artist, and there's this separate product out there. That's why you can have an artist who's a bad person who makes a beautiful or very nice piece of work. If somebody plays the piano for me, I hope they're a nice person, but they might be a terrible person. They can still play the piano really beautifully. So the work of art is a sort of a separate thing. And for me, it helps to stand back from it. And when I'm writing it, I think about it all the time. I'm inside it. But when it's done, I step back and I need to objectively see what works and what doesn't work. I don't take it personally. I think it might be different if you do, if somebody does poetry. I always thought that poetry, especially personal poetry, if I'm trying to make ironic, funny poetry, if I want to make fun of the British Prime Minister, and you can tell me if it works or doesn't work, you say, oh, David, it's too broad or it's too esoteric, I'll accept it. But if I'm writing some poetry about how I feel about like life and death, and if you don't like it, it might hurt my feelings. It might be like, oh, but that's me. That's who I am. It's like, oh, so I'm not a good person. The sort of books that I do, especially nonfiction, and I think even fiction a little bit, it's different. You really want an objective feedback.
But then you have the courage to trust someone who may not be part of your circle, and with the hope that the other person will be decent about it and not leak it, for example, and be fair.
Yeah. So I suppose there's a certain amount of trust. If you never, and the trust was verified, you came back with sensible and useful comments. But I suppose you also want to take a boundary on the trust. So even with my close friends, I don't give them like detailed, confidential financial information, not because they'd be malicious, but I know if somebody gives me something, I might leave it on my desk. Casually, accidentally, somebody else might see it, or I might by accident leave it in a public place. So we still, you know, we limit that. Think of the things you'll say to new friends, to really close friends, to family and children. There's sort of like hierarchies going up.
Right. Lovely. I think, David, thank you very much for your time. I'm sitting with a few of your books, and this is an audio podcast, so not everybody will be able to see this. But when we release the video, of course, there is E is equal to MC squared, which is this brilliant book that I am on to right now. Half of it, where you write about history of the equation, which is pasted on people's t-shirts, the simplicity of it and the whole story around it. And then there's Einstein's greatest mistake, the life of a flawed genius. And Electric Universe, where you've got praise from Bill Bryson of all people. So I'm quite looking forward to reading that. And just one question. So how do you, sure. You know, you write about science, and I think science and finance are the more difficult subjects to write in a manner that people can easily consume. So what is the hack, or what is your technique of you know, going about these things? If there is a journalist out there and if you have some tips for them.
Sure. I just realized I'm going to answer the question, and I'm going to begin it the same way I realize I've answered almost all your questions. I always say, well, there's two things. So here again, there's two things. One, use personal stories when you can. And two, really important, make sure the story is relevant. Make sure the story captures the essence. I don't know if you've ever read an article where they begin with some personal story, but doesn't really get to what the thing's about. However esoteric a field is, if you can find a personal story that's really relevant, that gets into the heart of what it is, then it becomes easy, because we're always interested in personal stories. We have to be careful. It's not the same as making somebody entertaining. If I, for example, because Einstein is so famous, we're always interested in him. For example, in Berlin in the 1920s, he kept a parakeet. Well, that's interesting. He liked scrambled eggs and strawberries. That's interesting. I can list 20 things like that, which are all charming and interesting. You might tell your friends, but you don't learn anything about relativity or Einstein from those. But what's maybe more important is what he looked for in life. He felt maybe for him, in his view, maybe God doesn't exist, but maybe there's an echo of God in the universe. Can I hear that echo? Well, that's very interesting. That makes you learn about Einstein, and you also learn about, wow, you're beginning to understand his physics. So if I were giving advice, if possible, about people, but come to the essential point, and not just superficial or irrelevant aspects.
So the entertaining bits or anecdotes will add color, but it shouldn't deflect from the main meat as to what the man did to make a difference, whether it's Einstein or anybody else. Is that what you're saying then?
Exactly, that's it.
Yet I got a good little cocktail party payload from E=mc², where Einstein's sister says something interesting, is that he would throw things at her that could punch a hole in her head, and I quote, and she says, "This should suffice to show that it takes a sound skull to be the sister of an intellectual."
Yes, that's a great anecdote. It's very entertaining. Yeah. But what I like about that anecdote, and I think I can't remember if I mentioned in the book, I know I mentioned in discussions, that's actually a very relevant anecdote. So his sister kept a memoir of what it was like growing up with Albert. And it's I think you can maybe get it online. I got it as a printed copy. Mm-hmm. And it's valid. It's accurate. There's many stories about him that aren't true. But these are true. Anyways, within her memoir, she had about 30 or 40 things about him. What I liked about this one is it shows a sense of humor. It takes a thick skull. So immediately that's funny. And the moment I wanted to illuminate, why was Einstein so much smarter than other people? Well, he had a specifically German-Jewish sense of humor. I'm Jewish myself. You always come in from a different angle. Instead of saying, whoa, he hit me in the head, that's unfair, I said, she's stepping back and taking a fresh angle. And that's what Einstein always did in his creativity. Yeah. You come in and one thing, and you're used to coming back with a fresh, surprising angle. When I used to teach in England, I taught at Oxford for a number of years, and there were some students who were very good students. If you gave them a question, they would have memorized every answer. That it's like building a ladder going straight up. But they weren't creative. They had no idea of coming in from a fresh, surprising angle. So I'd sometimes say, look, I'm going to give you this grade. To get the top grade, what I recommend is instead of studying more, go to stand-up comedy clubs. Hang out with some of your friends who tell stories. Joke around with your friends, and it'll relax your mind. You'll end up being more likely to come in with a fresh angle.
The unlikeliest of advice from a professor at Oxford.
Yeah. So first, you need to know the basics. You absolutely need to know the solid basics. Einstein studied physics and math quite well. But then for the extra level, well, think of it at sports. So Usain Bolt, when he was in the Beijing Olympics, the fastest 100-meter man there was. What he did before the finals was he went to McDonald's, he had a chicken McNuggets, and then I think he took a little nap, maybe listening to some music, and slept. Now, if you were to say, David, here's how you can become a great Olympic runner, eat chicken McNuggets and sleep a lot, it wouldn't work. But at the top level, at the very top level, what you need is they're all very fit. Usain Bolt and the people he was competing against, they had magnificent bodies. Their legs were really strong, terrific fast muscles. They practiced leaping out of the starting blocks over and over and over and over and over, the wind resistance, everything. They're all like that. So what you need at that top level is the ability to relax, the ability to chill and relax for those last minutes. And that's the difference between really good and genius. It doesn't mean you can only do these genius things, but if you're already at that good level, the extra stuff.
Lovely. On that life lesson, thank you very much, David, for your time on this podcast.
Thank you very much, sir. Okay, till soon.